Welcome to the Create the Future with Rick Williams podcast. Conversations with leaders who made difficult decisions and built lasting legacies. I am Rick Williams. I speak and write about how leaders can be more successful. My best-selling book, Create the Future, is your essential guidebook for making difficult decisions. This podcast is an opportunity for me and for you to hear how leaders with a wide variety of backgrounds have managed the challenges they faced, made difficult decisions, and had courage when going forward is tough. You will learn important lessons from other leaders. You will find that engaging with our 30-minute conversation will be a great investment of your valuable time. So let's get started. Welcome to the Create the Future podcast. I'm Rick Williams. The Create the Future podcast is a forum for leaders to share their story about difficult decisions they've made for their company or any organization, and in some cases for themselves. My goal is to share these stories about leadership and making tough calls with a broader leadership community so you will become a more successful leader of your organization. So we have a great guest today with a compelling story to tell. We'll hear about lessons learned and what they experienced. I'm excited to introduce you to Paige Arnoff Fenn. So Paige is the founder and the CEO of Maven and Moguls. I hope we'll hear a story about where that name came from, a marketing, branding, and communications firm based in Cambridge, Massachusetts. So welcome to Create the Future podcast. So Paige, introduce yourself and tell us a little about your journey up to this point.
Thanks so much, Rick. I'm excited to be here today. So I actually started my professional life as an investment banker in the 80s in New York City. When I graduated from college, my senior year, the Wall Street movie that Michael Douglas made came out. I saw it and I got completely hooked. It was kind of a crazy time, and I made a two-year commitment, and I realized in the first few weeks it wasn't really what I thought it was going to be. What makes a great movie does not make a great career choice. But I made a two-year commitment, and I learned a lot and met some amazing people. But I knew I wanted to go back to business school and kind of do a reset. So okay. I went back to business school, and my first semester, I took a marketing class. I got the highest grade in the class, got a summer internship in marketing, and I've been in marketing ever since. So I have kind of three chapters to my marketing career. I started at big consumer products, Fortune 500 companies like Procter & Gamble and Coca-Cola, very well-established brands. You know, P&G invented the concept of brand management, big budgets, well-known brands. And you just really, it's like branding boot camp. You really learn the ins and outs with companies that are extraordinary at what they do. They're always number one and sometimes number one and number two in their categories. So that was my first chapter. But then in the mid to late 90s, the internet 1.0 started taking off. And I just got enamored with all the, you know, there were so many articles about all these technology businesses raising tens of millions of dollars, doing all these cool things, and they were moving so fast. And I decided I wanted to quit my big, cushy corporate job at Coke and go work for a startup no one had ever heard of. I think my boss and my mom both thought I was having a nervous breakdown. But they thought, you know, just take a vacation. You need to relax.
And I'm just going to stop you for 1 second. So I'm hearing you making two big decisions in your life about your career. So this has been a big issue for you, making sure you're on the right path. And you've made already in your story two important decisions. This is great.
So I joined a startup, and they had raised, you know, I don't know, significant money, but not P&G and Coke money. And we wanted to put this brand on the map. I was the first head of marketing, built the team from the ground floor. We went public less than 2 years later, and we were sold to Yahoo. So that was like a dot-com success survivor. And then my husband, we were living in LA at the time. My husband got a job in Boston and Cambridge, so we moved back to the East Coast, and I decided I wanted to do it again. And at this point, you're talking the summer of 99, and I joked it was the summer of love for marketing people because there were so many startups by then, and Boston was a hotbed of activity. And because of my kind of pedigree with college and business school and an blue chip marketing and a successful exit, I had a lot of job offers, and I picked another company to go work for. And less than 2 years later, we were sold to the largest privately held media company in the world. Everyone thought I, made it with the IPO on the first one. But the truth is, when you're in the prospectus, you're locked up for a significant amount of time, like 6 months. And by the time I could sell my stock, it wasn't worth as much as it had been. But when a private company buys you, they write you a check and you can take it right to the bank. So that actually was a much better deal than I think people were more impressed with the IPO. But if you ever have a chance to sell to a private company, I would give you advice to take that deal. Then I did another startup as the head of marketing. And less than 2 years later, we went public and we were sold again. So I did 3 dot-coms, had 3 good exits. I call them my 3 base hits. I made a little money 3 times. I am not Sheryl Sandberg. I didn't work for Google and Facebook. I did not make $2 billion, but I had a great time. I learned a ton, and I really got to apply all the marketing lessons and experience that I had. At that point, 9/11 had just happened, and marketing jobs dried up. I hung out a shingle to start helping organizations who needed help on a more granular level. And that was 24 plus years ago, and I've been doing it ever since.
Oh, that's great. Okay. Well, that's a great history. Now, okay, I've already called out these career-changing decisions you've already made, but I know you want to talk about really tough decision that you had to make early in the life cycle of your current company that I think is really important for people to hear. So tell us a little bit about that.
So when you go back and get an MBA, and when you're studying these legendary cases of business issues, you're making a decision as if you were the CEO. You learn how to be decisive, and you learn how to look at data and weigh the risks. And I've always been a pretty decisive person. I think with my own firm, when it's your, name at the top and it's your baby, I named the company, I built everything from the ground floor. I attracted the right people, great clients. Honestly, the issues that came up that were business problems, I started my company before social media, before the Great Recession, before AI. So there were a lot of pivots professionally. As all these new things get thrown in front of you, you have to kind of, twist and turn and figure out how you're going to deal with all these new challenges. But those are just business decisions. I was always very clear-headed. I think the things that really got to me along the way were the people decisions, both the colleagues that I brought on to the company and our clients. Those are the decisions that were always the toughest ones to make and that really kind of punch you in your gut. I think the hardest lesson I learned early on was that the people you start with are not always the ones that kind of grow with you. Early on, I had started with people that I knew from previous lives. We had worked together or had a connection. And then as we grew, I added to the network. Some of the earliest people who were really good at the ground floor, rolling up their sleeves, helping us go from the first building block to the second and the second to the third. I realized early on that some of those people, as we were growing pretty quickly, we quadrupled year one to year two, we tripled year two to year three, we doubled year three to year four. So as the base was growing, the rate was slowing down, but we were really getting some good traction. And I saw that I had a couple of one-trick ponies in the group. They were really good at the stuff we started doing, but as we were scaling pretty aggressively, they were not keeping up. They wanted to keep doing the same things that they were comfortable doing. And I think when you work for a company that's in kind of a high growth mode, and you're being thrown a lot of obstacles that you're having to learn and deal with, you want people with a growth mindset that really kind of learn, and they realize they've got to kind of get up to snuff on all the new stuff. And it might not be things that they're initially expert in, but they need to be open-minded, and they need to really have that curiosity to keep going. And there were a couple people that I felt were kind of holding us back, frankly. They just kept wanting to go back to what was tried and true. But, you know, when you're facing some of these new tools and technologies and new setbacks with the Great Recession, you can't just keep going back to the well. So my personal preference is to give people the benefit of the doubt. And I grew up in the South. We have a saying, you dance with the date that brung you. And I had people that, you know, we're there at the beginning, but they weren't comfortable as we needed to expand. And I made the tough decision to let a couple people go early on. And it was hard to make that decision, but it was absolutely the right decision to make. And I know that once they moved on, the bar got a lot higher. And people, it was a great signal to send to the teammates who were coming with me, that, you know, we're an A team and we only want to attract the A team, and we want to be like at our best all the time. And, you know, I'm glad I learned the lesson when I did. I wish I'd learned it a little bit sooner. I wish I'd kind of gotten more comfortable in that position. But once you kind of do that, it really does permeate the culture. And like I said, the people issues are everything. If you don't have the right teammates on your bus, you know, you're not going to, even if you're going in the right direction, you're not going to do as well as you know you can do. So that one was a really tough learning.
You are describing a problem that leaders face frequently, and that is, in your situation, you're talking about your company in its growth phase and people who could not adapt to the requirements as the company got larger. So these are people you'd worked with, in some cases, for a number of years, you were close to. Talk a little bit about the process that you and, if applicable, other people in your leadership team went through to come to the point of saying, you know, we have to make a change here, and how you, in the end, decided to do that. I think that would be helpful to people. I'm sure this is a sort of slow realization process. And was you getting feedback from other people? Is it something you saw as a decision you had to make by yourself? Kind of what was the process that led up to the point where you finally made a decision to make these changes?
There were some signs that they were kind of out of their comfort zone, getting a little bit insecure and feeling threatened, because they could see the types of clients that we were working with, and the team. These were people who early on were some of my busiest people in the group, and they could see that other people were getting busier doing other kinds of work. I think it made them feel threatened. And again, my bias is to give people the benefit of the doubt, to kind of work with them and make suggestions like, let's prioritize professional development. There are a lot of new things going on. We need to get better at this stuff. We've got some new people who are, you know, as we were growing, I was adding people to the team. And I guess in the early days, I had a bit of a star system where a few people were really kind of the busiest, and they could feel that they were not kind of in the lead position anymore, and it made them very uncomfortable. So their interactions with other people in the group were a little more strained, and it wasn't something that I talked to other colleagues about as much, but they might come to me with some, you know, so-and-so's acting a little weird, or so-and-so made a very weird suggestion on, like, we were working on this project and they kept trying to do it this way, but we're not doing that anymore. What's going on? So I had kind of my kitchen cabinet of advisors, and it was very obvious to me that the buck stops with me, and this is not going to get better with time. And you realize there are people that are just more comfortable in more structured situations where you can I worked at big companies. I worked for VC-backed startups. Yep. That is a very different experience than working for a small single-member LLC organization. I self-funded the company. It was not as highly structured even as a VC-backed startup. And, when you're in a bigger environment, you can hide a little bit, or you can niche down to something that you're good at, and you could be that go-to person. And you can just kind of fly under the radar a little easier than you can with a group. I started with, a half a dozen, 10 people, and, then we were growing to about four dozen people. So we were growing, but there wasn't a lot of places to hide. And when you see the breadcrumbs, one thing, it's just an off day. Then you see something else. Well, that's kind of strange. The third time you're saying, this looks like it's going to be a trend. And again, you have to kind of follow the data and try not to be emotionally connected to the outcome. Like, look at it as clear-eyed as you possibly can. And when you realize this is not going to get better with time, they've made it pretty clear they're not willing or interested in kind of growing the pie, if you will. I want people with that growth mindset who believe in professional development, who believe we can always do better, get smarter. I want to be that professional service firm that's really a partner, not a vendor. I want our clients to know that we have their back. We're giving them the best advice for them. It's not about us. Our story is our client's story. If we help them succeed, we are doing a great job. And
so now let me just pause you for 1 second here. You are saying some things that can be extremely helpful to people who will hear this. You have gone through a process of having to deal with deciding whether you're going to terminate some people that have been very important in your company. And you mentioned that you have an effect, kind of a kitchen cabinet. So one of the questions is, how did you use that kitchen cabinet? Who do these people tend to be? So it wasn't a board of directors or anything like that. Talk a little bit about how you used your kitchen cabinet when, A, coming to the point where you realized you had to make some decision, and then finally making a decision. I know you've already said you had to make these decisions yourself, but you used, at least bounce ideas off, wanted to hear feedback from, experience from other people in your kitchen cabinet. How did you use them as that tool for helping you come to the point of actually making your final decision and carrying through on it?
So the people that were part of my kind of advisory board, if you will. Okay. We never met as a group. These are people that I had relationships, strong relationships one-on-one, former colleagues, classmates, bosses, and people that have worked in or around the startup community. So I had a lot of respect and admiration. I knew these people had my back. My husband is in that group. He was a fellow entrepreneur growing a business pretty aggressively as well. And you need a reality check. You need people who can be a cheerleader at times, but also kick your butt sometimes and hold the mirror up and share their experience and learning. And I knew, there are times when tough love is needed. And when I started getting the same message from people, and because, again, I knew these people, I knew people who knew them, and I didn't want to be alarmist or crazy. And I did behind the scenes talk to people, and I said, does this seem like something that could be problematic? And what was most interesting to me is it wasn't that surprising to people who knew me and knew them. For the people that didn't know them at all, it can be pretty clinical, like it's just a data point and they can extrapolate from their own experience. Yep, I've had those situations. It's tough. You know what you need to do. But for people that knew me and knew them, they could see how something like this could happen. Like, wow, your company has been really successful. People do recommend you, refer you. I can see why this is not working well for them, because I saw that in the other organization when I worked with them. They did tend to get threatened, or they did feel uncomfortable if they were, no longer the go-to person. I've seen this with my own eyes. Yep. You're not crazy, and it's not going to get better. And I'm sorry you're dealing with it. I think it's amazing that they contributed as well as they did while they were doing it. But I think you know what you need to do now.
Let me just ask you this question. So you use your kitchen cabinet to get feedback to kind of confirm what you're hearing and experiencing and help you think through in your own way what you should do about this. When you got to the point of saying, you know, okay, I really got to act here and make a decision, what did you do for yourself, for managing yourself? Did you say, okay, I'm going to go for a walk and think this through, or go to the gym, or just wake up in the morning and said, damn it, I'm doing this today? Or how did you manage yourself in moving to the point of, okay, I'm actually going to move and get this done?
Well, I think I hit a tipping point. I think I realized, like I said, it was a trend. The facts were pretty crystal clear. It was black and white. And yeah. I just had to buck up. I mean, being the leader of an organization, the optics matter. You can't just say, you know, words about your value, your corporate values and mm-hmm. what matters. If you don't live it every day, it's an authenticity and integrity thing. You really have to put your money where your mouth is. And I had an opportunity to present the conversation because these are people that I was still interacting with regularly. And mm-hmm. it just came up in a very natural way that I don't think you're happy here. I can tell you're not having fun the way, you know, we did in the early days. I don't think this is a good fit. I really appreciate what you've done, but I think we're both going to be better off if you move on. Shake hands and part ways. And I wish you well, and I appreciate the fun that we had together, but I don't think it's working right now. And obviously, it's a tough conversation. You have to do it. And ironically, I think a lot of the stuff that they pushed back on and really fought, they've continued to fight. I mean, I don't know that they've ever made peace with the fact that, you know, it's in seeing how they've kind of moved forward, it was absolutely the right decision. No question. Mm-hmm. And I do think I got the best success out of them when they were kind of at the uptick. And I feel like right. that was the highlight of their careers. Probably even they might admit that at this point, I'm not sure, but it's tough.
I know you want to share the story of dealing with a very difficult client. So why don't you get into that? So we'll hear that story as well, because this is another version of what do you want your own business life, your personal life to be like? And you've now talked about dealing with an important colleague or colleagues, but now how about dealing with a difficult client?
So this was one of my very first clients. They signed a $10,000 a month annual retainer. So not an insignificant client in the first 6 months. And we were doing public relations for this client. I have a great PR team and they were just killing it. Like from the first month, they were getting him really high level press, small business owner. And he was being very slow to pay. And just not a lot of positive feedback from working together. And on month three, so the team, I'm in Boston, the client was in Boston, the team was mostly in New York City. So we met virtually, but the client was going to be in Boston, so we were going to get together in person for the first time. So I was really excited, and we get to the conference room table, and I say to the client, before we dig into the agenda, you've got the team here in person. Maybe let's just start. Maybe you could thank them for all their hard work and we can talk about some of these early successes, you know, to have started less than 90 days ago and see the kind of traction you're getting is really phenomenal. And the client looks me dead in the eye and says, I'm sorry, you want me to thank you? I'm paying you. Why would I thank you? And I was like, whoa. And this was in front of the team. So I was a little bit horrified. I already thought he was a pain, but this was kind of crossing a line. So basically, I kind of took the opening and I said, yes, you are paying us. But in fact, we haven't gotten the money yet for the second month. And the third month is starting today. So maybe before the end of our meeting, you could walk back to your desk, grab your checkbook. So we can get caught up for the next kind of tranche of work. And he kind of blew me off and we dug into the agenda. Well, at the end of the meeting, I really had an epiphany kind of listening to him during the course of the meeting. And I thought, you know, I know the guy's a jerk. My team knows the guy's a jerk. And I'm guessing everybody knows this guy's a jerk, the people that, you know, he comes into contact with. And like I said, we had gotten him some very high-level media. He lived in a Boston suburb, and one of the articles we had was in the local weekly newspaper for his town. It's a free newspaper that they put at the dry cleaner, at the coffee shop. And while we were going through the agenda and we were talking about all these amazing, you know, blue chip media coverage he was getting, he said, you know, I just want to stop you right there. It's nice being in the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times or whatever, but I got to tell you, the one that really got me going was, and he names the local, you know, tab newspaper that is the freebie at the dry cleaner. And he says, I can't tell you, like the whole week, everyone was stopping me on the street, at the coffee shop, at the dry cleaner. I was so, everybody knew me. I was so famous. I loved it. And I thought, oh my God, this guy believes all of his own press. This is not a good sign that he doesn't even value the things that he should for his business. All he wants is to stroke his own ego. So the meeting, we get through the agenda, we're wrapping up. And I said to him, now, if you don't mind, if you could go back to your desk and grab that check. He hands me the check. And I said, to be honest, I think at the end of the month, we should shake hands and part ways. I don't think we're the right team for you. And he was kind of stunned. And he said, are you firing me as a client? And I said, I guess so. I think you're going to be better served from another group. And I mean, he was stunned. And that was it. We finished our work at the end of the month and we shook hands and parted ways. And my biggest fear, honestly, was that all these people that knew him professionally or even personally, they knew he was a jerk. They knew he got some really high quality press that made him look great. And that if I could do that for him, imagine what I could do for them if they're not as big of a jerk as he is. And I didn't want to build my entire business practice with people that I don't want to support like that. Those would not be my choice of clients. And so it was really a lesson to me that, like, you know, I have a very low overhead business. If I don't want the business, I shouldn't accept the money, even if they're willing to be a six-figure client and sign a year-long engagement. If that's not the kind of work I want to do and the people that I want to do it with, I need to say no right away. And it was an important lesson to learn in the first 6 months of my business, because it just, again, the optics matter. My team knew that I had their back. They were sitting at that meeting feeling so deflated for all the great work they had done. And when we were walking out to our cars after leaving the meeting, it was like they had a, you know, lightness in their step. They were smiling. They're like, I can't believe the way you ended that meeting. That was amazing. And it's like feng shui. You shut down the things that are drawing your energy and you open up space for new things to come. We refilled that business. You know, within 6 weeks, we had much better clients, and I've never, ever gone back to just taking whatever business comes my way.
Talk a little bit about your feelings at that end of the meeting. I can imagine that you were angry, embarrassed for your team, angry at a guy who would be so disrespectful of you, also a little bit afraid of, gee, this is $100,000 a year client. I mean, talk a little bit about how you were feeling yourself and managing your own feelings as you went through this.
Well, it was uncertainty. I didn't know that I would feel the relief that I felt. I could tell looking at the team in the parking lot, I had made the right decision no matter what happened. But it was a little scary sitting in that meeting with the team who I respect. I admire the work they've done. And the guy was rude. I mean, he was a jerk. And again, I grew up in the South. Manners matter. I want to work with people and for people that I enjoy spending time with. I don't, you know, I took the job on Wall Street out of college because they offered me a lot of money. And I learned that lesson pretty quickly. Like I said, in the first month, I knew that was probably not a great way to make a job decision. And I stuck to my guns by not going back to finance after business school. But when it's your company and your name on the door, whether, my company name is different than my personal name, but people know that I'm the founder and the CEO. And so, you vote with your wallet. And if you're not putting your money where your mouth is, if your core values are about authenticity and integrity, and you're not comfortable in your own skin making those decisions, you gotta trust your intuition and your gut on that.
Right. You're also raising the importance of values in making decisions that so often, we, and I'm kind of going back to our shared business school training, say, oh, it's just the numbers. It's just a numbers game. Oh, it's just business, blah, blah, blah. In truth, if we're not living our life with values as an important part of how we live our life and the decisions we make, we're not going to be successful. And certainly we're not going to be living the life that we want to be living. And what you're sharing with us is an important example of values as a core determinant of how you conducted your business.
It's the lens that you look through to decide where to put your time and your energy and your
Right.
blood, sweat, and tears.
Well, let's wrap up with a little. Tell us a little bit of story. Where did the Maven and Mogul's name come from? What are you communicating with that miscommunicator?
So when I started forming the org, so I had clients before I realized I was starting a company because I had run marketing at three venture-backed startups. I knew a lot of investors and board members, and I had a lot of classmates who were in the kind of small business community. And people came to me after 9/11 and said, "We fired our marketing department, or we fired our agency, but we have a new product coming out, or we have a trade show coming up, and we really need some help. Can you help?" And I could help, but I never worked on the agency side. I was never a service provider. I was always the client. My husband's like, "There's a red flashing sign in front of you. These people trust you. They know you. You've been doing this work. Like, you can do this." So I called all these people that I knew from my previous life, and I jokingly referred to the women as the marketing mavens and the guys as the marketing moguls. So, right after 9/11, I had this team assembled, and we knew we could roll up our sleeves and get the work done. And I said, again, I came out of a more professional environment. I said, "Well, if we're going to do this, we need a website. We have to look like we know what we're doing."
Okay.
College buddy of mine wanted to learn how to program. So she did the programming. I wrote the web copy. And I said, "I keep calling everybody mavens and moguls when I email the group, but we do need like a real name." So I put together an email and I sent it to like 100 people, and I had a bunch of names on the list. Most of them were quite serious names. I knew I didn't want to use my personal name as the company name, but we were checking integrated marketing solutions, strategic marketing advisors, very serious names. And I threw in mavens and moguls because I thought, that's kind of my cute name. Maven, by the way, is a Yiddish word for expert. My great grandmother would have said it meant know-it-all. She would have not have liked that name. And a mogul, if you look it up in Merriam-Webster, is someone of rank, power, or distinction in a specified area. I like the alliteration, and I just, the marketing mavens, the marketing moguls. Anyway, I sent out the email to a lot of people whose opinion I value. They were other marketing people, potential clients, potential people that would refer business to us, attorneys, accountants, friends of mine in the investment community and venture capital, private equity. I sent out the list and I said, "Do any of these names kind of sound like a good name for a new marketing consulting firm?" And there were three people that when they responded said, "Here are the names I like the most. The only name I thought was really bad was Mavens and Moguls," or "Whatever you do, don't pick Mavens and Moguls." Okay, so, but Mavens and moguls made it into like the top five of the majority of the responses. So I was like shocked. I was pretty surprised. So about 2 days after I got the responses back, one of those three people who hated the name called me and said, is it too late to change my vote? And I said, no, no problem. We're still working on the website. And she said, I have to admit to you, I know I picked names that I thought were good, but the only name I can't get out of my head is that damn Mavens and Moguls. Like, she said, I think maybe that should be your name. And then I told her. And so then I called back one of the other people that hated Mavens and Moguls. And he said, so I'd put together what's called a concept test, which you learn about at P&G. Company X helps you with your marketing and advertising and branding and PR. Company X can do this. Company X can do that. And fill in the name for Company X. And then you give them a list. And the guy that I called who said, I hate that name, Mavens and Moguls, he said, honestly, Paige, I picked Company X. I thought that was the best name you had on the whole list. I said, that was not an option. That was a placeholder. So I feel like I knew at that point it had to be Mavens and Moguls. And the truth is, it's a fun name. It's not serious, but we don't take ourselves seriously, but we take the work very seriously. And I just feel like it's a conversation starter, like you. How did you get the name? You know, what does it mean? Right. And so once you get into a conversation, the door is open. And right. If you're a marketing and branding company and you don't have a good name, what does that say about your ability to do marketing and branding? So I think it's helped us a lot.
Well, Paige, this is wonderful, a wonderful conversation. Thank you for sharing your experiences with us. You've made a valuable contribution to understanding the challenges that leaders face every day with these great stories. So how can people who are tuning in, our audience, learn more about you and Mavens and Moguls?
So go to my website, mavensandmoguls.com. It's MavensandMoguls. And I'm also on LinkedIn. That's my platform of choice. You'll see my last name is hyphenated. But on LinkedIn, it's all smushed together. And as one of my clients always says, there are too many words between my hyphenated name and the ampersand in between Mavens and Moguls. She's like, all I ever remember is Paige and Mavens. And when I Google it, you pop right up. So thank goodness for search engine optimization. You can always find me that way too.
Well, that's great. So I want to thank our audience for taking the time to engage with our guests and learning from our guests. If you have a compelling story to share about making a difficult decision, please contact me. Go to rickwilliamsleadership.com. Again, that's rickwilliamsleadership.com. And go to the Create the Future podcast section on the website. Again, that's rickwilliamsleadership.com. Remember that you create the future by the decisions you make today. Take time to get your important decisions right. And yes, have some fun. Until next time, be well. What an interesting and inspiring conversation. I hope you found it as valuable as I did. Thank you for listening. Let me know if you have a compelling story to tell about making tough choices for your organization or for yourself. Coming on my podcast is a way to share what you have learned with a wider audience. If someone you know would be a great guest, please make an introduction. I welcome leaders with a story to tell and important learning to share. You can contact me about the podcast at podcast.rickwilliamsleadership.com. That's podcast.rickwilliamsleadership.com. Please share the link to my podcast with your colleagues. They will thank you for getting them access to these valuable conversations. And finally, please give us a great rating on and subscribe to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Amazon Music. Just search for Create the Future with Rick Williams. Thank you for listening to Create the Future with Rick Williams podcast. Conversations with leaders who make difficult decisions and build lasting legacies.